السلام عليكم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. All praises are Allah's, Lord of the worlds. And may His peace and blessings be upon our Master, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and His pure Immaculate Ahlul Bayt.
Allahumma
salli ala Muhammad
wa ala
Muhammad. Yesterday we went through Imam Khomeini's letter to some degree, emphasizing the importance of irfan or tasawwuf, where the aim was to see beyond the physical realm and to be able to qualify as a seer. You have to be born twice. In order to be born twice, we have to eliminate the ego. How to eliminate the ego? Fattabi'uni. The Holy Prophet said, follow me. And we ended there. This imperative, follow me, has two dimensions to it. And if we have time, I wanted to cover both dimensions tonight. One is that, who is it that we have to follow? It's a human being born 1,400 years ago and had a mother, had a father, and we say he was ma'soom at birth. This is important. We have to understand how someone can be born ma'soom. Otherwise, we don't follow anyone. We only follow someone who is infallible. Rationality dictates that. Otherwise, why should we follow any person? We have to understand why and how someone is born ma'soom and what the practical implications of that are for us today. That's one dimension. And if we have time, the second dimension is this: following the Holy Messenger has differing and varying degrees of obedience attached to it. Now, that's more of a practical protocol for us to spiritually elevate by following those three. So these two we have to understand in order to be true followers. The dispositions, the inner traits, one's spiritual status quo, one's ethics, one's mental status, one's bodily status, all these are acquired from our previous generations, one's parents, grandparents, and so on and so forth. Even the intentions of one's parents, the way they think, the way they behave, the way they treat people, the manner of thinking of our grandparents, great-grandparents, all these 1,001 different parameters, bodily and mental and spiritual, have a say in our creation at birth. Even the parents' intentions at the time of conception plays a role. During gestation plays a role. How are the parents thinking? How are they earning? What are they eating? All these play a role according to the logic of the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt. I'll mention a few of them. Now, the reason this is important to acknowledge is because a certain degree of one's destiny is in the hands of those before us. It's an important point. You can't deem these different generations as mutually exclusive to one another. They follow from one another. It's a link, and we're responsible for future generations. the way we think now, the actions we do, the money we earn, the food we eat, all these play a role in all the generations that succeed you, your children, great-grandchildren, and so on and so forth. From moment to moment, all your actions play some role. Now, the degree, it differs, and we'll never know exactly. Now, this can be problematic for some people to absorb this, that a significant degree of one's destiny is in the hands of those before us. When it comes to the medical or physical realm, everyone accepts it. For example, a mother takes certain medication, the child is born without a limb. Okay, that's his destiny has been shaped to some degree. This disability was a consequence of actions from the previous generation. No one can deny that. Now, you may say, is that fair? Well, it's not fair, but don't bring Allah into the equation. Don't question Allah's justice. It's a natural consequence of actions committed by previous generations. Sometimes the great-great-great-grandfather may have done something, and that may have a biological effect, and that biological effect may be realized many generations later in a child. These things are documented in medicine and so on and so forth. We don't have a problem there. But when it comes to spiritual parameters, when it comes to referring to the doctors of spirituality, there we question everything because we're so drowned in the physical world, we don't even understand or want to understand. When the woman is pregnant, every week they'll go to the midwife, they'll go to the doctors, take folic acid, different medications, they take everything. Why? Because they know there are risks if they don't take it. There are risks which may be transmitted to the next generation of children and offspring and so on and so forth. But in relation to the spiritual realm here, then we all fall short. And then the child is born with a number of different defects, bodily and spiritual. And then we say, why? But then it's too late to go to the doctors of spirituality who know the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, what they mean, and so on and so forth. Now, there are many traditions on this, and inshallah, that will be the main part of the discussion, especially in relation to the first dimension of Fattabi'uni. There's one tradition that the Holy Prophet, he prescribes a set of instructions to Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam and Lady Fatima alayhi salam on their wedding night. Now these two are ma'asum already, and he's giving them a set of instructions. Why? Because of the offspring which are to come. He wants to maximize the spiritual and bodily status of the offspring which is to come. Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, alayhi wasalam. It's a long tradition, and I won't be reciting all of it. It's a weak tradition, but just because it's a weak tradition, in aqa'id, we don't discard weak traditions just because they're weak. Especially when there are many traditions giving the same meaning. Traditions which are sound, these weak traditions bear significance even. Now, I'll be going through the sound traditions and the weak ones, but I just wanted to mention, just because a tradition is weak in aqa'id, we don't just put it aside. There's still a lot of use in it, especially when the logic of the Qur'an supports it. Nisa'ukum harthul lakum. Your women are like a cultivating ground for you. That unicellular embryo, after 9 months, becomes a 3-4 kilogram child. Where has the child got all that flesh from. The way the mother thinks, the way the mother eats, the way she behaves, to all she's building this child moment to moment. Now in this tradition, the Holy Messenger says, Ya Ali, la tujamir imra'ataka fi awwal ash-shahr wa wasatihi wa akhirihi. Night of the wedding here. So don't execute intercourse at the start of the month, the lunar month, the middle of the month, and the end of the month. These are now spiritual doctors speaking. We only understand the folic acid part of life because we're so drowned in this physical realm. We don't even accept these kind of things. Now look what the tradition says. He says, don't do that. فَإِنَّ الْجُنُونَ وَالْجُذَامَ وَالْخَبَلَ يُسْرِعُ إِلَيْهَا وَإِلَى وَلَدِهَا. Because insanity, kind of psychosis, or جُذَام, skin disease like leprosy, خَبَل, dementia, will be passed to the woman and to the child. In these kind of traditions, the point is the potential is there. The reason I say the potential is there because there are 1,001 different parameters at play. No one is saying definitively this will happen, but the potential is there. Depends how the other parameters all combine and blend together. You see, the responsibility of the parents in relation to the succeeding offspring, even this matters. In the same tradition, it says, don't do that action ba'da dhuhr, in the afternoon. And it says, if you do it, it has an effect on the eyes. In some traditions, it say, in the same tradition, another sentence, la tatakallam indal jama'. Don't speak during the action. It'll have this effect. Don't look at X part of the body during the action. It'll have that effect. The tradition keeps on going. Secrets of the cosmos. Then one says, Ya Ali, la tujami' imra'ataka bishahwati imra'ati ghayrik. Don't enter into that action by means of you being excited to another woman and then you approach your wife. فَإِنِّي أَخْشَى, the Holy Prophet says, I fear. إِنْ قُضِيَ بَيْنَكُمَا وَلَدْ, if a child is procreated from you two, أَنْ يَكُونَ مُخَنَّثًا مُؤَنَّثًا مُخَبَّلَ. So if a child, a son, male offspring, walad, is procreated, I fear that it will be effeminate, woman-like, the male offspring, and مُخَبَّلَ. I'm not sure what that means. Maybe it's from خَبَل, which means a form of dementia or something. But you see, and then the traditions, a lot, many, many instructions. And then it says when to commit the act, the good times, and the positive potential, I stress, the positive potential outcome if you do it at certain times, and so on and so forth. The point is that the parents are responsible. They have this degree of responsibility with them. In Ziyarat Warith, Ashhadu annaka kunta nuran. I bear witness, I bear testimony that you, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, were a light, fil aslab shamikha, in the lofty backs. Lofty backs means in the sperm of your male ancestors. والأرحام المطهرة, in the pure wombs of your female ancestors, you were that light. The light meaning all your preceding ancestors were all pure people, pure fathers, pure mothers. They thought purely, they acted purely, they behaved purely. That purity was creating generation after generation a pure light within that sperm, within the womb, within the egg. It all has an effect and it's transmitted generation after generation. لم تنجسك الجاهلية بأنجاسها. You weren't, the era of ignorance never polluted you with its contaminations, because the mother was always pure, grandmother, great-grandmother, keep on going. The father was always pure, father, grandfather, and so on and so. The lineage of the monks, they were all pure people. They acquired that for themselves. Now, in that lineage, you have all pure mothers, all pure fathers. They think pure, they act pure, they earn pure at conception, before conception, after conception, during gestation, all that. You'll produce an offspring whose bodily and spiritual constitution is perfect. And this perfect spiritual constitution we call ismat, infallibility. Such an offspring is pure. Such an offspring won't need an ustad anymore. Because of that purity, they will be in touch with the angels. Being in communication with the angels is a function of one's purity. They won't need an ustad. There's no need for guidance in relation to these people. And that's one of the rational reasons behind infallibility. And modern medicine is going that direction. They say if the mother is, during her gestation, in an environment where there's a lot of noise, it will cause her to be more stressful. You see, it's going there. But for now, it's the mental traits. It hasn't entered the spiritual yet. But modern medicine is going in that direction. Sometimes you see a mother and father aren't particularly religious, but the son or the daughter become very religious. That's because maybe their grandmother, their great-grandmother, they did something, they thought in some manner, they did certain actions, it has an effect. When that effect becomes realized, it may be many generations down. You look at converts, for example. Do you think it's easy to convert from a religion that you're born in, like Christianity, then you convert into a Muslim? And we were all born Muslim and we take it for granted. It's almost impossible to convert to another religion. That true conversion. It doesn't happen, it's very difficult. Do you think that when a brother or sister converts to Islam, they should take all the credit? For example, they're 16 or 20, 25 years old. That in that time, they reach that capability and capacity to convert for themselves? No. They made some effort, of course. But you have to go back in their lineage. Their Christian fathers and mothers, grandmothers, great-grandmothers, so on and so forth. They were believers. They may have done incredible actions. And one day, many generations down, it led to their descendant becoming a Muslim. And when the convert becomes a Muslim, it will be a day of joy for them who are in Barzakh. They will be day of jubilation for them. They will receive heavenly provisions. Because this was a result of their actions. Something great for them. So there are many actions which have a significant positive or negative effect on the offspring. Some actions have more of a bad effect than others. And here then Islam enters the arena a bit and the Sharia brings guidelines. One of those actions which have a very negative effect, more so than those other actions, which is, it's more of a potential effect, although with this too, it's more potential, but it's serious, the threat is serious, is when the child is born out of wedlock. Yes, now here, there's a significant potential threat here to the child as a result of what their parents did. Now let me first clarify this, that Islam has no bias against those who are born out of wedlock. They can reach as much spiritual perfection as anyone else. The potential is there. These biases are a result of social taboos and everything. Otherwise, Islam doesn't have any bias there. However, because of the severity of this threat, that this child, because of what their parents did, their spirituality is at more of a risk because of their parents' actions, and the potential is stronger for them to be misguided. Islam prohibits such people who were born out of wedlock to enter sensitive professions. Professions wherein the salvation of people are at stake, such as being a marja or a judge. Here, the marja, the judge, people's salvation is at stake here. It's a very sensitive position. If the marja goes wrong, if the judge goes wrong, people will be led to deviation and rebellion and so on and so forth. Not that the child born out of wedlock can't acquire that perfection. No. Not that the child can't even maybe the most intelligent of all the marriage. It's possible. He may have that knowledge which is so high. But Islam, as a precautionary manner, a precautionary measure, because of the significant, in this certain sin, the significant potential threat, can't play around with the destiny of people and say, look, you're just as equal. But in these professions, no. It's not your fault either. But the responsibility has to go with the previous, but still, there are some things which can't be compensated. The mother, for example, has this medication, or the father smokes or whatever. The child is born without limbs, for example. Well, that child can't be an athlete anymore. I mean, certain events they can't, for example, enter because of that disability. And it's not the fault of the child at all, no. But that country where the child belongs won't bring him into the Olympics, for example, to enter a certain race or something. These things happen. Okay. Now, Avicenna, in one of his works, he goes through a lot of parameters that are very influential in the bringing up of a pure offspring, both in the bodily sense and the spiritual sense. I only want to mention one of those parameters, and I'll read the text of Ibn Sina here. It's in Arabic, and it has a lot of points. And then it's also buttressed by traditions from the Ahlul Bayt. He says that that parameter is breastfeeding, suckling. أما كيفية إرضائه وتغذيته, concerning the manner of breastfeeding the child. فيجب, it's necessary. Now this necessary isn't a canonical necessity. It's something it's good to do. فَيَجِبُ أَنْ يُرْضِعَ مَا أَمْكَنَ بِلَبَنِ أُمِّهِ. It's necessary to breastfeed with as much milk from the mother's milk, as is possible, as is feasible. فَإِنَّهُ, verily this milk, أَشْبَهُ الْأَقْضِيَةِ بِجَوْهَرِ مَا سَلَفَ, من غذائه. This milk is the most similar thing to the substance that it used to be in relation to the child's food. وهو في الرحم, when the child was in the womb. أعني, i.e. تمثى أمي, the blood of the woman. This milk is the most similar thing to that which used to be the food of the child in the womb, and that's the blood of the mother. The child used to, the fetus used to feed from the blood of the mother. This milk is the most similar thing to that. فَإِنَّهُ بِعَيْنِهِ, this blood itself, هُوَ الْمُسْتَحِيلُ لَبَنَان, is converted to blood, to milk. The blood is converted to milk. وَهُوَ, this milk, is أَقْبَلُ لِذَلِكَ, is the most befitting thing for purposes, for these purposes, i.e. of feeding, of breastfeeding, nutrition. وَأَوْلَفُ لَهُ, and it's the most familiar thing for the child. It's that thing which is most familiar, the child knows best. حَتَّى أَنَّهُ قَدْ صَحَّ بِالتَّجْرُبَةِ, it's even been proved by experience that أَنَّ إِلْقَامَهُ حَلْمَةُ ثَدْيَ أُمِّهِ عظيم النفع جدا في دفع ما يؤذي. It's been proved by experience that the mere grasping of the mother's bosom by the child, the mere grasping, not even having the milk, is of extreme benefit and eliminates a lot of those things that potentially harm the child. وأما شرائط المرضع, concerning the prerequisites of the person who breastfeeds now, not canonical prerequisites, just to have a maximal effect on the child. فَسَنَذْكُرُهَا, we'll mention them later. وَنَبْدَأُ بِشَرِيْتَةِ سِنَّهَا, but we'll start with the prerequisite of age. What's the best age? Now this is Avicenna speaking. Avicenna was someone respectable. What he says isn't 100%. I'm not saying it's revelation, but it's someone who's was a scholar in Islam and in many other sciences. It's worthy to know, at least. Concerning the age, فَنَقُولُ, we say that أَنَّ الْأَحْسَنَ أَن يَكُونَ مَا بَيْنَ 25 سَنَةً إِلَى 35 سَنَةً. Best age for breastfeeding is between 25 and 35. That's his opinion on his empirical data. It may be 15 to 35, I don't know, but this is him saying this. فَإِنَّ هَذَا, this age group, هُوَ سِنُّ الشَّبَابِ وَسِنُّ الصِّحَّةِ وَالْكَمَالِ, it's the age of youth, it's the age of health, and the age of perfection. وَأَمَّا فِي أَخْلَاقِهَا, now this is the main paragraph I intended, that was just a preface to this. Concerning the akhlaq, the ethics of the woman who wants to breastfeed. فَأَن تَكُونَ حَسَنَةَ الْأَخْلَاقِ, she has to be of decent ethics. مَحْمُودَتَهَا, praiseworthy ethics. بَطِيئَةً مِنَ الْإِنْفَعَالَاتِ الرَّدِيَّةِ, she has to be slow in being susceptible to vicious ethics. She has to be someone who doesn't quickly become susceptible to bad ethics. They are so strong that they don't easily become susceptible to vice when they are surrounded by it. Examples of vice, min al-qadab, anger. People who are calm, they don't become angry quickly. Wal-gham, depression, not clinical depression, but. Wal-jubn, cowardice. They're not cowards, they're very strong women. وغير ذلك, and other vice. فَإِنَّ جَمِيعَ ذَلِكَ, all these different vices, يُفْسِدُ الْمِزَاجِ, destroys the mizaj, the bodily and spiritual constitution of the body. It destroys the constitution of the body. وَرُبَمَا أَعَدَى بِالرِّضَى, and this destruction of constitution may pass through breastfeeding. وَلِهَذَا نَهَى رَسُولُ اللَّهِ عَنِ اسْتِدْعَارِ الْمَجْنُونَ, and therefore the Holy Messenger had prohibited, not in the canonical sense, people from having, using those who breastfeed, women who are insane. He would say, don't let the insane breastfeed. Now, 1400 years ago, this was a good custom in Islam, especially in the Arabian Peninsula. The Holy Prophet also had a mother who breastfed him, different to the genetic mother. It's a good custom. And the reason why it's good will be evident in a minute. But these good attributes can be transmitted to the offspring. The more mothers, it doesn't matter. This is something we have in Islam. Today it's become extinct, this sunnah. But it is a sunnah. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he even, in one of his marriages after Lady Fatima alayhi salam, where he knew about Karbala, for procreation he said, I want a woman from Bani Kalab, because they have certain attributes. And Umm al-Baneen alayhi salam was the woman he chose. Hazrat Abbas alayhi salam was something which Amir al-Mu'mineen wanted to offer for Karbala. How could he bring an Abbas into creation? It was through a certain mother with certain attributes. You see, these things happen. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam in one tradition has said, "Unzuru man turdi'u awladakum fa innal walada yashubbu alayh." Observe those who are breastfeeding your children, because that child will be blended with the mother's attributes, mix with her. Observe, pay attention to it. In another tradition, Imam Baqir alayhi salam, استرضع لولدك بلبن الحصان, breastfeed your child through someone who is of decent ethics. وإياك والقباح, and refrain from using someone who is of ugly ethics. Then he gives a principle, an important principle that the Ma'soom gives. فَإِنَّ اللَّبَنَ قَدْ يُؤَدِّي, it spreads, this milk, it spreads, meaning that good ethics, that bad ethics, it spreads through milk, it transmits through milk. See, this was 1400 years ago. Islam has a program how to build communities. Marriage isn't just something physical and, you know, this worldly. Marriage has responsibilities with it. I'll come to that in a minute. عَلَيْكُمْ بِالْوِضَاء مِنَ الدَّعُورَةِ, I enjoin you, Imam Baqir alayhi salam says, those who breastfeed to have wudu. فَإِنَّ اللَّبَنَ يُعَدِّي, because milk verily it transmits. You give milk whilst in the state of wudu, it'll transmit. Okay, now that's one point. The next point, I'll just give a small introduction before we get to this next point. Whatever is in this world, in this cosmos, we call the in the realm of Takwin, the providential realm, the cosmic realm, whatever is here. The Sharia and its laws are extrapolated as a result of what is in this realm. The Sharia isn't a conventional thing. It's extrapolated by the cosmos, the rules of the cosmos. How nature is, the law of nature. Our Sharia is based on nature. It's on a par with nature. There's one tradition, just understand this point. I mean, Rumi Minin's tradition, where he said, لَيْسَ شَيْءٌ تَغِيبُ أُذُنَا إِلَّا وَهُوَ يَبِيدٌ وَلَيْسَ شَيْءٌ تَدْهَرُ أُذُنَا إِلَّا وَهُوَ يَلِدٌ. Whatever creature whose ears are concealed, they go inside, they're not apparent, they lay eggs. Whatever creature whose ears are apparent, they give birth, like mammals. You see the relationship here of what is in nature. Just because the ear is in or out, it leads to a certain action depending on where the ears are. You see, there's a relationship here. Now, let's go to the Sharia now and see what the relation between the Sharia and all this is. Someone comes across eggs in a jungle. They ask the Imam, we don't know if this egg is from a halal meat animal so we can consume it, or from a haram meat animal so that we don't consume it. The Imam gives a very important formula. مَسْتَوَى تَرَفَاهُ فَلَا تَأْكَلْ تَأْكُلْ is better. If the two ends of the egg are uniform, don't consume. If nature brings about through its cause and effects an egg through an animal whose two sides are uniform in size, don't eat. Meaning it's haram. See, this haram has been extrapolated from something which has happened in nature. Nature has led to an egg having two uniform sides. Because of that, Islam says it's haram to eat. It's problematic to eat that. And then he continues, وَمَخْتَلَفَ تَرَفَا فَكُلْ. If there are differences between the two ends of the egg, then eat. This halalness has been extrapolated from what's happening in nature. In another tradition, مَا كَانَ مِنْهُ مِثْلُ بَيْدِ الدُّجَاجِ فَكُلْ. If the egg is like the egg of a chicken, it's okay, eat it. And that's, it's not uniform, the two sides, the egg of the chicken. But then we see the eggs of snakes or some reptiles who are predators. We see that their eggs are uniform. There's a reason why we have halal foods and haram foods, because it has an effect on the soul. The reason predators are haram to consume is because you'll become a predator in action. That's why the wolf is haram to eat. The lion is haram to eat. It has an effect on what you, who you are. The snake is also haram to eat. And then these haram, like reptiles or like snakes, the two sides are uniform. Imam says don't consume. Even animals which have predator instincts, they're not predators, but they have predator instincts, they even are haram to consume. That's why the rabbit is haram to consume. The reason why cattle are permitted to eat is because they are inert animals. It doesn't really have too much of an effect. They're harmless. However, eating too much meat will make you inert too. like cows, sheep, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, Islam is a protocol of eating. Then we see pigeons, sparrows, all these are halal meat birds. Their eggs are cone-shaped. They're not uniform on both sides. But even amongst the birds which are halal, some birds are najasa consuming. They are less coned. They're still not uniform both sides. But you see the difference is less on the two sides than other halal birds which are not najasa consuming. You see, even the snake, with those attributes of the snake, leads to an egg uniform. It's haram to eat. This halal animal who is najasa eating, like a duck, for example, who eats a lot of dead flesh and so on and so forth, there it's okay to eat. But you see, even there, the egg isn't as asymmetrical as other birds. So it's all having an effect on the soul here. So diet matters. Now, when we eat too, it matters in relation to our offspring. Because the duck who eats like that, it leads to the egg being less asymmetrical as a result of what it's eaten. Some birds who live very high up, you see that it's more oval, their eggs. See, even place matters. Place has an effect. Diet has an effect. Now, these are physical things. Your thinking has an effect. Your instincts have an effect. What you eat, how you earn, how you speak, how you think, how you behave with people, all these are having an effect. Now, this is a code in nature for parents to observe when intending to procreate. And then Ayatollah Hassan Zadeh Amuli says, and all this was because of this sentence, says that the ultimate wisdom in marriage is to establish a human form, not merely to satiate one's needs. You want to build a human, not a human who just has a human physical phenotype. You want to build a spiritual constitution. You may marry in wedlock, a halal marriage, but produce a child which is spiritually illegitimate because of the way you thought, the way you behaved, the way you earned, the way you ate. The snake with its snake attributes is producing offspring with those attributes. You can also produce snake attributes when you hurt people, sting people, do this to people. You're creating a snake rather than a true human being. See, marriage is a big responsibility. You're forming the next generation. You're bringing an offspring that you want to be human in the real sense of the term, not just a biological human. Anyone can do that. Even animals can do that. But we're humans. And this is something important to take in mind. Okay. Now, we have, it's 8:15. I can either start this now, because I have words of Musiba to read. I think I'll leave this dimension of it. The Fattabuni is in relation to actions now. It's a protocol of action. We'll start that tomorrow. I did want to finish it quickly, because I want to go through as many talks as I can, many themes I want to cover as much as possible. Okay, so I'll go through the Zikr Musibat, I think is important here. Lady Fatima alayhi wasalam was ma'soom. She was a product of the Holy Messenger. What happened after Saqifah? Many people hit her. One of those people, which there's no need to mention the name, someone went to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and said, how could this person hit Lady Fatima alayhi salam? This tradition is in Bihar al-Anwar. Imam Sadiq replies in this way. Now, the answer you should understand after what we've gone through today. He says, Abdul Muttalib, the grandfather of the Holy Messenger, you have to follow this, it can get a bit tricky here, had a female slave. Slavery at that time existed when Islam came. Islam did everything to get rid of slavery. In the Sharia, there are many mechanisms put in play to keep on freeing slaves, and it contributed a lot to the abolition of slavery in that area of the world anyway. It took longer in this part of the world. He had this female slave. The female slave didn't have piety, taqwa. The female slave one day goes in the valley to pasture some cattle. A male slave passes by and the two become intimate and have a child. Once Abdul Muttalib finds this out, well, this was, you know, adultery and everything. It wasn't done in a canonical setting. Islam has nothing against sexuality and so on and so forth, but it has to be done according to the Islamic code. He was so embarrassed, he said, look, here's this money, because he was a very generous man. He gave this money to the slave and said, now go with the child, go away from here, because you've embarrassed me a lot. So now we have a mother with this child born out of wedlock. The child, after 15 to 20 years, I can't remember the tradition exactly, becomes intimate with the mother. It's a male child. And the male child becomes intimate with the mother, and they produce a female offspring. Now, this was very embarrassing for them. Around the people, and they said, okay, let's give this child to Hisham ibn Mughayra to nurture. We can't bring this child up. After 15 years again, this son, who was intimate with the mother and produced a female child, 10 or 15 years later, I think, I can't remember the exact number of years, he passes by a house where this girl is, not recognizing the girl at all, and asks for her hand in marriage. Now the girl is her daughter through the mother, and they marry. And look at the genealogy here. And then the offspring was a male, and that male was one of the people who hit Lady Fatima. Look after how it, what it went through. It's important. Genealogy is important. You don't have to believe in Amir al-Mu'mineen as the successor of the Holy Prophet through traditions. Just look at the genealogy of Amir al-Mu'mineen and the genealogy of those who considered to be the successor of the Holy Prophet. It should be evident who's the successor of the Holy Prophet. Anyway, if that was one tradition in Bihar al-Anwar. Tonight and tomorrow in Zikr al-Musibat, it's a Shia reference. I'll be reciting tonight and tomorrow. The other two, the last two nights, I'll be reciting from Sunni references, very legitimate ones. And what we'll read in the Shia references, you'll see them all cropping up, the same language in the Sunni references. Sunni references in the 2nd and 3rd century after Hijrah. Very authoritative books. In this tonight, Zikr al-Musibat, I'll read half of this letter. It's a letter that the second Khalifa, during his Khilafah, he wrote to Muawiyah, describing to Muawiyah what happened after Saqifah. Maybe it's 2 or 3 days after Saqifah that he's explaining what happened. So Umar now is now, it's him, so his words that he's giving. And as I say, inshallah, in 2 days' time, we'll go through the Sunni references too. فأتيت داره مستشيراً لإخراجه منها. So I came to his door, his house, Amir al-Mu'minin's house, so that I may lead to his being exited from it. فقالت الأمة فضة. فضة spoke, who was a servant of the household of the Ahlul Bayt. وقد قلت لها, I said to فضة, قولي لعلي, say to Ali, يخرج إلى بيعة أبي بكر. Although Abi Bakr is also okay, but Abi Bakr may be more accurate. The reason he's called Abi Bakr, it's the father, meaning the father of a virgin, because the only wife of the Holy Prophet, the only marriage that he had with a virgin was Aisha, and she was the only virgin. Now, in relation to Aisha, it's popular now that she was 9 years at the time of marriage, but this is a historical discussion. Specialists in history have to go through this. It's acquired popularity amongst the common lay people, but in Qom now there are many specialists, including Ayatollah Madadi, in history, that is proven historically that she was 18 at that time. But I mean, these things, there are many things like this. The age of Lady Khadija, it's popular that she was 40. Many historical experts give another age. The time of the Bi'sa of the Holy Messenger. These, there are many things which history, there are many variations to it. We can't say this is the historical truth 100%. History has this weakness that it can never be 100%. Anyway, قولي لعلي, Umar said to Fidda, say to Ali, to exit, to give allegiance to Abu Bakr. فقد اجتمع علي المسلمون. After all, the Muslims have given consensus to his successorship. فقالت, Fidda said, إن أمير المؤمنين مشغول. Verily, Amir al-Mu'mineen is occupied. And he was busy compiling from day 3 or 4, he stayed compiling the Quran in a particular fashion and commentating on it. فقلتو, I said, Umar, خلي عنكي هذا. Forget all this talk, وقولي له, and say to Ali, يخرج وإلا دخلنا عليه وَأَخْرَجْنَاهُ كُرْهَا. Tell him to exit, otherwise we'll enter the house and exit him reluctantly. فَخَرَجَتْ فَاطِمَة. Lady Fatima, meanwhile, exited. فَوَقَفَتْ مِنْ وَرَاءِ الْبَابِ. And she stood behind the door. فَقَالَتْ. And she said, أيها الضالون المكذبون. O deviant ones, O fabricators of the truth. ماذا تقولون. What are you saying? وأي شيء تريدون. What on earth do you want? ما تشاء يا عمر. What do you want, Omar? فقلت. I said. ما بال ابن عمك. What's happened to your cousin? Referring to Amir al-Mu'mineen. قد أوردك للجواب. He sent you out to answer. Whilst وجلس من وراء الحجاب. Whilst he himself is behind the curtains. فقالت لي. She said, Lady Fatima said to me, طغيانك يا شقي أخرجني. Your tyranny, O wretched one, has made me come out. وألزمك الحجة. And your tyranny has necessitated the final proof over you. فقلت, I then said, دعي عنك الأباطيل وأساطير النساء. Abandon such women tales and women's talk. وقولي لعلي يخرج, and tell Ali to exit. فقالت. Lady Fatima replied, لا حباً ولا كرامة. There's no dignity, no respect in you. أب حزب الشيطان تخوفني. Are you scaring me of شيطان's party? يا عمر. وكان حزب الشيطان ضعيفا. The party of شيطان is weak. فقلت. I, عمر, then said, إلم يخرج. If you don't exit, جئت بالحطب الجزل. I'll come with splinters of wood. وأدرمتها نارا. And I'll burn the house down with fire. على أهل هذا البيت. وأحرق من فيه. And burn those who are in it. أو يقاد علي إلى البيعة. Otherwise, or علي has to submit to giving allegiance. وأخذت سوت قنفذ. Then I grabbed onto قنفذ's whip. Inshallah, the rest I'll continue tomorrow. وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله. اللهم صل على محمد.